Hello and welcome to another episode of Theatre Voice. My name's Matt Truman. The actor Jonathan Pryce has had a remarkably varied stage career. His CV hops from Shakespearean leads to Broadway musicals via the premieres of some iconic new plays. Trevor Griffith's Comedians, The Caretaker by Harold Pinter, Edward Albee's The Goat or Who is Sylvia, and now, in the West End, Florian Zeller's latest expressionist piece, The Height of the Storm. Heather Neal covers a lot of ground in this overview interview, zooming in on some of those landmark productions, so I shan't say too much more, but I will add this. What I really love about this interview is that Pryce, usually unprompted, repeatedly returns to his experience of audiences. Listening to him, you get the sense that an actor's art isn't necessarily what he or she does with what's been written, but rather what he or she does with those watching. In The Height of the Storm, Pryce plays a novelist, Andre, alongside Dame Eileen Atkins as his wife. It's a slippery piece of writing. One of the two may or may not be dead. So, Heather began by asking about exactly that ambiguity.
It's part of the joy of doing the play is that it doesn't worry me where I am. In the sort of time scale of the play, whether it's today, tomorrow, yesterday, or whether I'm dead or whether I'm alive. And I think that's the beauty of the play, why I chose to do it, is that it's about performance, and it needs to be performed because the audience can make their decisions themselves about all these issues. Because when I first read it, I found it totally confusing. I began to understand it on a second reading, and on a third reading, I ended up with tears in my eyes at the end of it. And it's again, it's about performance. It's not a play to be read. The majority of the time, there is this buzz in the audience as they turn to each other and say, what do you think's going on, what's happening? And it's a kind of excited buzz. I'm waiting for the night somebody, because I have a line in the play where I say, I don't understand anything at all. And I'm waiting for the night that some bright spark's going to shout out, neither do I.
But you particularly like the stage because of the interaction with the audience, don't you?
I think so, yeah. I try to choose pieces that on the whole belong in the theatre. I mean, I have done things that I've also done on television, like the Caretaker, which works very well on television or on film, but things like this and the Shakespeare that I've done in the past, that they belong in the theatre, and that's why I tend to gravitate towards those kind of plays.
And the audience for this varies, does it, from night to night? The reactions vary, or from
it varies. Depending. I mean, we've been on tour for a month. We did Richmond, Cambridge, and Bath, and we tended to find that the older the audience, the more the immediate understanding of the play was, because it's about younger people dealing with elderly parents. And you tend to find that with the matinees that are predominantly aged people, they latch onto it straight away.
Well, however confusing it you might say it is, or the audience might find it, it seems a brilliant exploration of bereavement and long-term love, doesn't it? Whatever has actually happened, we do get that from it very clearly.
Well, I've described it as a life in 1 hour 20. And it's almost every aspect of a life lived with a partner or a husband or a wife, and who especially have children. It works equally as well for people who don't have children or are not in long relationships. And the beauty of it is that when you talk to audience members afterwards, or they choose to write to you, it has affected them all, you know, very, very strongly. Mm. There's a great emotional reaction to the play. It deals with issues that that are more and more prevalent, the problems of dementia,
yes,
and care of the elderly.
Yeah.
It does. The audiences are quite different. I think the evening audience is much more mixed, and I'm always gratified when I meet young people who've got it.
Yes.
But anyone can take anything they want from it. That's the great thing, and it's it's one of the things that Ventures I've been most nervous about, but because it's about it is about approval in a way of the audience. They and the audience being a part of it.
Yes.
They can't. It's not the sort of play where you can sit back, relax, and have a good laugh. Or you know, it's you become part of it.
Was it hard to rehearse?
Yeah, it was. It was hard to learn.
Yes.
Because
it's not linear.
It's repetitive, yes. And you think I've just said that, haven't I? You've said it in another life in a slightly similar way, and there are. It's a part of the beauty of the writing as well. Certain words are echoed by
yes.
different actors throughout the play. Nightmare, circumstances, we have to change the situation.
Yeah.
I think it's only been done once. It has only been done once before in Paris.
Yes.
And as the father was written by this elderly, written for this elderly French actor, so was this piece. But when he was 92 when he played this part,
goodness.
Just over a year ago, and then sadly he passed away. But I'm not quite that old. But it must have been our director Jonathan Kent and Christopher Hampton saw this 92-year-old actor, and they reported back to me that they were incredibly moved. And I said, well, of course you were. He's 92. He's still standing up and speaking and learning lines. But there is something wonderful about the celebration of old age in this.
Yes. Well, Eileen Atkins has said that she envies your ability to cry on stage. But is that something that comes easily?
It's not in the script that you cry.
Oh.
I'm afraid the easy answer is to say that I'm Welsh and we cry all the time. We don't cry because we're Welsh. This touches me as much as it touches the audience.
Yeah.
And my parents died quite a long time ago now, and my father in 1976, and he was...
Yes. You were young, weren't you, when your father died?
I was 28, I think. Mm. And but I'm the same age now as my father was when he died. That's a rather spooky thing.
Mm.
And I, you know, I'm... he was 2 years... He was attacked in his shop, and then he had a series of strokes. And so he was almost 2 years in the dying number. And there are elements of Andre's personality with dementia that mirror what my father was going through with the strokes. My father couldn't speak.
Oh.
And it was a terrible effort for him to communicate. And, Andre is speaking, but he's not in control of his speech sometimes, and other times he's very lucid. I do draw on the things from my family, the things to do with, especially my father, who I wasn't that close to. I loved him as a father, but we didn't do a lot of things together. And
and you were already away quite a lot by then.
Yeah, I kind of left home at 18, really. Mm. But I'm still working out my relationship with my father, and I'm doing it through work.
Yeah,
you know.
Oh, well.
Yeah, it's a healthy way
well,
to go about things.
You started off planning to be an artist, didn't you? And then you trained to be a teacher, and then you got a scholarship to RADA.
Yeah.
After which you spent 2 years at the Liverpool Everyman.
Yeah.
In that amazing period when this. Anthony Scher was there, and Julie Walters, and all sorts of people.
There were two parts of my life at the Everyman. I went there as an actor. I got my first job there, almost straight from RADA. I was employed because I could sing. And Tony Haynes, the musical director of the production Caucasian Chalk Circle, which was going to happen at the Everyman. When I was at RADA, he was the MD on Oklahoma.
Ah.
And I was in the barbershop quartet singing the high tenor line, Poor Judd Is Dead. And Tony knew he needed someone who could sing high tenor for the role of the narrator in Chalk Circle. So he told Alan Dosser about me.
Wow, that Alan, was yeah. That's an amazing.
Yeah, Alan Dosser came down to London, saw my final show, and revealed to me, many years later, he didn't stay for the whole show. But he left a note at the stage door at RADA saying, there's a job for you at the Everyman if you want it.
That's fantastic.
So I went there, worked there as an actor for 2 years, and then later went back, not long after, but I did a year at Nottingham. And then Alan Dosser took a sabbatical, and almost the entire company left to go to London to do the Beatles show. So I applied for and got the job as a caretaker artistic director until Alan came back.
Yes, and you really have done almost everything.
Well, this was in the first 3 years. So well, to that company, I mean, Julie Walters and Bill Nye and Pete Postlethwaite, that was my company. Oh. I employed them. Tony Scher was there with me as an actor previously.
You just mentioned Nottingham, and that's what I'd like to get to next, because 1975, Comedians, the part of Gethin Price was written specially for you, wasn't it, by Trevor Griffin?
Well, I think Trevor knew that I'd been in the company for a year, and Trevor had seen me work, and he knew that I would play it, so I think he shaped it to what he thought I could do. It was unlike what was happening in theatre at the time. It was, I mean, Trevor and at the time David Hare, Howard Brenton, they all came from political theatre. We'd done a series of plays at Nottingham dealing with local politics, Brass Neck, and various other pieces, I can't remember now. We remounted Caucasian Chalk Circle there, which was set on a building site, and it was about the unionization of building sites. They'd managed to twist Brecht to what we wanted. And, you know, I said before about finding a difficulty with this play because it has to be performed. I was, I think, quite a long time getting that character, especially in the performance in the middle section.
With the tailor's dummies.
Yeah.
Yes.
Just how to do it and where his... Well, I knew where his anger was coming from because, I mean, I was young.
I was going to say how much of the young Jonathan Pryce was in there. Was it...
Well, like, you know, all my previous work at the Everyman, that was all socialist-based theatre. Yeah.
So
we were well clued up to it, yes. Yeah, and attacking the middle classes was what we all were doing at the time. I still meet people in the street who remember seeing it, remember being there. And I did it in New York. And it was kind of received well. It was a critical success. It didn't do very good business. It was on Broadway. Very difficult to sell that play on Broadway. And it was redirected by Mike Nichols, you know, the king of American comedy. But he'd seen our production in London, and he knew he really shouldn't have been directing it. And he said this to me, and he said that it should have been Richard Eyre again, but they were nervous about putting this play called Comedians on Broadway, and they thought they needed a recognisable name on the marquee.
You won a Tony anyway.
So. I won a Tony, I did all right. But it was the nature of the piece changed a bit because they didn't have the immediate football hooligan reference to make. But it did frighten them, and there was a night when this guy started blowing a whistle in the audience, and he was quietly removed. But he'd blown his whistle. This was the whistle he carried if he was going to be mugged or attacked. And he felt he'd gone completely. He felt he was being attacked.
Yeah.
So he started blowing the whistle because he wanted it all to stop.
Well, I had read that you'd actually pulled back sometimes when you realised the audience couldn't really take anything.
Yeah, I could hear people groaning and crying and doing, oh, God, yeah, it was horrible. Yeah, so you do have some kind of sensibility towards those people.
Well, you went on to all sorts of other things. You played a Bond villain and in Tomorrow Never Dies, and you've done films with Terry Gilliam, such as, in Brazil particularly, and you were Cardinal Wolsey on television for Wolf Hall. But then on stage, you were first... The big change was being the engineer in Miss Saigon, wasn't it? That was quite a departure.
That was quite a huge departure, yes.
And then you went on to leading roles in Shakespeare and Pinter. But before we talk about Miss Saigon, let's go back a bit, because in 1980 you were Hamlet at the Royal Court, and you won an Olivier there as well. And that production is always remembered for the possession by the ghost of Hamlet.
Yeah.
Was that really difficult to do? It looked so... visceral, the pulling out of another. It's because it isn't just the voice. It's as if like a whole character comes out of you.
Yeah, I don't think of things in terms of difficulty because the more you do it, and the more you rehearse it and practice it, you find a way of doing it. So it's actually you're not suffering too much physically doing it. I found a way of doing the voice that I could do without being on my throat. And it came about, Richard Eyre, the director, had been asked to do a play at the Royal Court. Any play he wanted. And he'd asked me before when we were at Nottingham to do Hamlet, and I hadn't felt ready to do it. I didn't think I had anything to say with it. And in the intervening couple of years, my father died. And I began to see parallels with Hamlet. My father died as a result of violence. I kind of got angry about it, but not as angry as my sisters were. And the young man who did, he was 16, the boy who attacked him, he went to Borstal, ruined my father's life, but he carried on quite happily. You know, it was that sense of, I began to feel by the time in 1980 that I hadn't done anything about my father. I hadn't avenged his death, not that I could or would or should, but I hadn't had that instinct to do it. And I began to feel a bit like Hamlet, who had not done anything about his father's death, even though he had suspicions about his uncle. And that also coincided with a time when I thought I'd seen my father standing in the garden looking at me. And of course, I don't think I did see him. I don't think he was there. And that, so I began to think of wish fulfillment. I really did, because he hadn't been able to speak before he died, and I was in New York doing Comedians when he died, and I would have one-sided conversations with him where I could hear noises at the end of the phone. So I was telling him everything I thought he'd want to know about me, but there was unfinished business, as people say, between us.
It was so personal.
Yeah. So this Hamlet's thing about seeing the ghost and having the suspicions about his uncle became about wish fulfillment. And so we had to jiggle the text a bit, but that I so wanted to see my father, I conjured him up from inside of me. And it was almost as if in a fit of possession. And I said all the things that I thought my father would want me to say. So avenge his death, Hamlet, you know. And that's how that happened. And Richard also wanted the ghost to be as frightening to a contemporary audience as it must have been in Shakespeare's time. And The Exorcist had been out in the cinemas, and it was one of the most frightened things I'd ever seen in the cinema. And that was with a woman who was possessed by demons or whatever. So I watched that film. I watched films of African women speaking in tongues in fits of possession. And it went from there. And it was quite extraordinary to do, because it was so bizarre to watch that when I would start it, the people in the audience would start to titter and laugh a bit, thinking this is weird. But then it goes on and on and on, and it becomes like this feat of endurance that if I can keep doing this voice. And so that and what I was saying, the audience were, well, hopefully as shocked as as an Elizabethan audience would have been.
It's a huge leap to Miss Saigon, but
Miss Saigon came about because of Macbeth. Two things happened. I'd done a play in New York with Patti LuPone, and I had never been to a musical ever. And because Patti was in Les Miserables, I went to see that, and I was completely blown away with it. This sort of what Coward says, the effect of cheap music, but it is the most extraordinary show, and it's completely sung through. And I watched these actors moving me to tears, and in a way that I didn't think was costing them much, because they were singing.
And whereas, you wanted to be part of it.
I was beating my head against the wall playing Macbeth every night, trying to get that audience response, and I thought I'd like a bit of this. And my agent James Sharkey, who was my agent from RADA until he retired, for almost 30 years he was the only agent I had, and he came to the first night of Macbeth when I had organized a cabaret in the Dirty Duck as a kind of party thing, and I sang Witchcraft backed by my three witches going do ah do and all this stuff, with Simon Russell Beale coincidentally accompanying me on piano. And my agent saw this and he said, I've forgotten you could sing, and I think you should do a musical. And I said, yeah, all right, yeah, okay, sounds okay. So so you then cut to the casting Miss Saigon a year or so later, and Nick Hyten is set to direct it. And he said, what we need, he didn't know me, he said, what we need for this role is Jonathan Pryce, if only he could sing.
Oh.
And Cameron McIntosh put his hand up and said, well, he can actually.
And you became the engineer.
Yeah. They
won a Tony and an Olivier.
Yeah,
didn't you?
Yeah, but I had two of the best years work I've ever had. I absolutely loved doing it.
I want to leap on now to The Caretaker.
Yeah.
You were Mick in 1980 at the National, and then Davis in 2009, very Welsh Davis.
Yeah.
Was your Davis influenced by the fact that you had done the play already? I mean, did you feel...
It was influenced by Warren Mitchell, who had played Davis with a Welsh accent. And he'd fought to play it with a Welsh accent, the director.
In the 1980 production.
Because we originally recorded it for television. And then after we'd recorded it for television, the National asked us to remount it in the theatre to celebrate Pinter's birthday. Warren wanted to play it Welsh, and Ken Ives, the director, didn't.
Yeah.
And this was like a couple of days into rehearsal. And Warren challenged Kenneth Ives to a game of tennis. And the outcome of that game would decide whether he spoke it with a Welsh accent or not. Now, I don't know if it was known generally, but Warren has his own tennis court, and he played tennis every day. He was a demon. And Ken Cranham and I were sent home to wait for the result of this game. And I think a couple of days later, got the phone call saying, it's okay, you can come back to work. And we went to the rehearsal room, waiting for Ken and Warren to turn up. And Ken Ives came through the door with his arm in plaster, where Warren had not only beaten him at the game, but I think he'd fallen, and so physically he was beaten as well. So he played it Welsh, and it fits perfectly.
It does.
Yeah, and it was. I also I learned a couple of things. Having recorded when we did it for television, I found it difficult to do Mick.
You were very frightening as Mick.
Yeah, but I don't think I was funny.
Oh, I see.
But yeah, there was no way of knowing in a dry studio.
Yeah.
So they the theatre asked BBC to hold on to that transmission until after we'd finished. So we did it for about 21 performances at the National, and re-rehearsed it for the stage. I still didn't think it was that funny. And then we had our first preview, and I pulled myself up. I'll sit with the chair. Warren as Davis is lying at my feet, and I'm being intimidating. And I say, you remind me of my uncle. Wouldn't touch a piece of fruitcake. And the audience fell about. And I was like, oh, I see. And Warren looked at me and winked. And it was like, yeah, that's what it's going to be like. And so that was great. And but I had to remember to do it seriously and as threateningly as possible. Mm-hmm. And the more serious I was about saying these nonsense lines, the funnier it was. And I retained that from when we redid it in the theatre, and this time with my playing Davis. But it was wonderful when we were in London all those years later, and Warren Mitchell came to a matinee, and he wasn't too well, and I waited until everyone had left the auditorium, and I went out to see him in his seat. And it was a very moving moment. It was like, really was like handing on the baton to somebody, and he loved what he'd seen. And I confessed to him that I'd stolen at least two bits of his business. Because I thought it was a silly thing that this filthy tramp taking his clothes off to get into bed. And Warren, when he did it, he would hold these filthy trousers up by the cuffs and wet his fingers and run his finger down the crease to put a crease back in it, and then fold them perfectly over the chair.
I remember you doing that.
So that was Warren's business. That was wonderful.
Yes.
He stole it from somebody else as well.
But you were a very angry Davis, weren't you? Sort of simmering all the time.
Yeah, I wasn't well. As a Davis, who wasn't well. You know, he's a man who was couldn't trust anyone, living on the streets, genuinely homeless, and just trying to... it was that awful thing that he'd ingratiate himself with whoever he thought would give him the best deal.
Yes.
And switching between the two brothers.
Yes, making a mistake.
Yeah, and they, of course, one of them is, both of them are smarter than him, but one incredibly smart, the Mick character, who manipulated him into revealing his weaknesses all the time.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful play.
Moving on, you acted with your wife Kate Fye in The Goat or Who is Sylvia at the Almeida. That was 2004, I think. Yeah. Was that particularly odd? Because it's a very odd play where the man has fallen in love with a goat when you're playing with your real spouse.
We get on very well. It might surprise you to know. And we worked together before. I directed Kate at The Everyman, and we'd done a television series together. And what was great for both of us is that she had to fight to get the part. She flew to New York to be auditioned by Albie, and he approves almost everyone who he had to approve, anyone who was in his plays in leading roles. And also we were a great unit with Eddie Redmayne and Matthew Marsh, and we became a family. So it was just not normal. I don't know. And I think the extreme nature of the piece was quite easy to do with Kate. And we both knew what the play was about. Again, it's a play that encompasses life's experience, and it's not about a goat. It's about a relationship, and it's about love, and it's about trust. And it's about the fragility of trust.
Yeah. Well, you've also acted with your daughter Phoebe.
Yes, yeah.
I think you've merchant of Venice at the Globe when you were an absolutely brilliant Shylock.
Again, like working with Kate, it was... Phoebe and I get on really well, and my fear was about whether people would think she was only doing the role because she was my daughter. I mean, she had to audition the same as anybody else audition. But what was so gratifying was the rest of the company, and it's quite a large company, the acceptance of both of us, and then knowing that she was there because she'd earned it. I mean, yeah. These days, you know, there's no, if you're part of any dynasty like they used to be, you're not going to get a part because of it.
No.
In fact, it's I think it's more difficult because people's expectations are greater, and they don't want to be seen to be giving somebody a part just because they're related to the leading man.
Well, there was an extra bit added at the end of that production, wasn't there, where the forced baptism of Shylock is shown, and Jessica is shown in terrible distress.
Yeah,
it's taken much further than a lot of modern productions, which show her thinking she's probably made a mistake at the end. But it's it was much more than that.
It was devastating. Of course, Phoebe can sing as well, and sang this Jewish lament for the dead, I think it was, and it was contrasting with the Christian choral singing that was happening in Latin at the same time, and it was devastating. It was I couldn't look at her. I didn't, because it but the effect that the whole thing had on the audience, because I think it was such a good production, and it was so clearly defined, the racism and the way that the Jews were treated then and reflected with the way they're treated now, or anyone, that any alien is. That's what it became about. It was about the mistreatment of the alien or the immigrant. And it was seen as a universal piece. It did have a profound effect on audiences. And it was also... You knew when you had a predominantly Christian audience in, because any time that I was going to be punished in some way, they applauded. And that was, I really wanted to turn to them and say, do you want to talk about this?
Well, the audience at the Globe do not hold back, do they? I mean,
no.
You wondered if someone might shout out, "Well, I don't understand either here." Well, they probably would at the Globe.
But it was like that last scene. You just could feel the atmosphere.
Yes.
Of the people.
Oh, and that's the opposite happens as well. Absolute
silence.
Involvement. Yes.
Yeah. And of course, we did a month in China. All we've been told was that don't be afraid, that they're very quiet during the performance, and at the end the applause will be rapturous, and yes, indeed, they were silent for the whole performance, and then almost silent for the applause, because you're looking out, and instead of clapping, they're all filming you with their iPhones, so they can't clap. You just see 2,000 iPhones staring at you.
Theatre Voice is an audio archive about British theatre. You can subscribe to the weekly podcast on iTunes or visit our website, theatrevoice.com, to find hundreds of recordings with some of the world's leading theatre makers. This episode was hosted by Heather Neal and produced produced by Matt Truman and Helen Gush for the Victoria and Albert Museum. Thanks for listening.